And I'd like to say something about why I chose to talk about Kavana. I think that, you know, like you look around and you try to say to yourself, like, what's the issue? You know, like everybody has, like, what's the issue? What is it that, what issue are the Jewish people involved with? So a lot of the issues that existed when I was young seem to have kind of evaporated. Like once Israel was a big issue, Israel, the state of Israel. I'm not sure it's such a big, you know, now that Israel is there, the state of Israel is there, and people don't really think it's going to disappear, even though there are some people in the world who perhaps hope it will disappear. But I don't think anybody thinks that Israel will disappear. So Israel is not an issue. You know, there was once an issue in Israel about what language they should speak here in Israel. And amongst the people who made the decision, no one thought the language should be Hebrew. Because the science professors said, well, you know, you have to teach in German. And the literature professors said you have to teach in French or English. And somehow Hebrew won out, which is an interesting thing in itself. And nobody talks about that anymore. In Israel, people speak Hebrew. Like, sometimes they also speak other languages. You know, either English or Russian or French, you know, as it may be. But the winner in the language competition seems to be Hebrew. So if you go to wherever you live in Israel, if you live in Israel, you go to a Gan, you'll find remarkably that all the children speak to each other in Hebrew. And that's what counts. It doesn't really matter what other languages the parents speak. But at the end of the day, the Gan determines the language that's spoken. So that for the Jews, a lot of the issues that once existed do not exist anymore. But there are new issues. There are new questions. And one of the new questions, interestingly enough, is Kavana. Is when we daven, what exactly are we doing? What exactly are we doing? We know that we are strictly following a very complicated set of rules. Even if you daven every day, or people who daven every day, find that those rules are palatable. I mean, you can deal with it. You know, there's a time, and there's a text, and there's a, you know, in shul, there's times when we all get up, and times we sit down, and everybody knows about that. Everybody knows about that. But Kavanah doesn't seem to be on the schedule. It's not something that really entices us. And it's something which I think we have to give a little bit more consideration to. Now, the Rambam asked the question, the Rambam Hilchot Tefillah Perek Aleph, the Rambam asked the question, why did Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, why did they create, invent, determine Shmona Esrei? Right? I mean, you know that Shmona Esrei has 19 brachot in it, but it's called Shmona Esrei because that's how it started. It started as 18 brachot. And the question that the Rambam asks is, what was it that made Anshei Knesset HaGdolah legislate Shmona Esrei? Why? What happened before that? Well, before they legislated the Shmona Esrei. So if you are read Tanakh in a cursory manner, and you know the Chazal knew Tanakh very, very well, very well, as we will see. But if you even read Tanakh in a cursory manner, you're impressed by the fact, that people davened. Something happened. They had a need. There was something that they wanted to accomplish. Rav Nachman of Breslov says that tefillah is about asking for a miracle. Right? Rav Nachman in Likutei Moran, part 1, 7. He says, when you daven, all you want is a miracle. Because if you didn't want a miracle, that means that the norm was okay. Everything was going on was fine. When you daven, it's because things are not fine. So you have to have some notion, according to him, of what a miracle is and what it means to ask God to do a miracle. But that's what he says. That's what davening is about. Davening is not about accomplishing a set of rules, even though, of course, he was in favor of doing that as well. But real davening is about asking for a miracle and hopefully getting a miracle. Hopefully getting a miracle as a result of davening. I mean, he also says that the reason this doesn't always happen is because people don't know how to daven. If they knew how to daven, they would know how to ask for miracles. So if Rivka and Yitzchak didn't have children, because they had established what the norm was. The norm was, this couple is not going to have children. The miracle was that they would have children. Sarah and Abraham, the norm, the teva, the nature of things said, they're not going to have a child. But they wanted that miracle to take place. So that then you go through the whole Tanakh, and the whole Tanakh is full of people who daven for miracles, and miracles that actually take place. What happened? What happened that somehow the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah looked around and said, we better provide a text. We better provide them with Shmona Esrei. We better have something that people can daven all the time. Now, you know there's a machloket Rishonim. The Rambam is alone in his position that davening is a mitzvah min haTorah, that it's midoraita, that you have to daven. Other Rishonim, like the Ramban, don't think that that's the case. They think, of course, you could daven. You could daven whenever you want. I mean, it's a wondrous thing to daven, but there's no mitzvah min haTorah for daily davening. According to the Ramban, there's, of course, a mitzvah drabbanan. There's a mitzvah drabbanan to daven twice a day. Shachrit and Mincha. When that mitzvah says, according to the Rambam, who says there's a mitzvah doraita, he says clearly the mitzvah doraita is to daven once a day, every day. That's what the Rambam says. Eventually, that mitzvah doraita to daven once a day, every day, morphed into twice a day. I do it twice a day. The Gemara says that twice a day comes to somehow as a response to the Beit HaMikdash, the lack of Korban Tamid in the Beit HaMikdash. There are days we're missing something. We were unable to kind of function properly because the Korban Tamid, which was given twice a day, every day, suddenly left. It didn't exist after the Churban Beit HaMikdash. So the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, they said, what can we do to give back something that was missing? Something was missing from the lives of the people. They were not able to bring the Korban. After all, the Korban Tamid was a Korban that was brought by everybody. Everybody together donated for the Korban Tamid, so that each Korban Tamid given in the morning and in the afternoon was a Korban that was brought by the entire Tzibur, so that it was something that affected you. It was part of your day, even though you may not have been in Yerushalayim. You may not have been actively involved. You weren't a Kohen and you weren't singing as a Levi. Nevertheless, you were doing something. You were participating, and that sense of participation was missing. So the Chachamim made a takana that you should daven every day, twice a day. According to the Rambam, you could say that the once a day obligation, right, the obligation to daven once a day, suddenly became a twice a day obligation. And according to the Rambam, in order lechatchila, I mean, like, you know, in learning, we like to make those kinds of distinctions, but l'chatchila, a priori, if you wanted to do the mitzvah of tefillah every day, according to the Rambam, you had to daven Shemona Esrei, and you had to daven Shemona Esrei twice. Yeah.
What was the time span between the stopping of the Korban Talmid and when Chazal made the Tekana?
I don't know. The Gemara says that Shimon HaPekule added the 19th bracha, which was much later. Anshei Knesset HaGdola, in the interim between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni. I have no idea. I mean, I just say things. Dates are very difficult. We have, when we learn, we sort of have a kind of negative position about history. I mean, that's another talk. That's another discussion. But that's how we are. We like to think of everything happening simultaneously. But I'm sure that the question is a good question and that there is an answer someplace in the world.
So then why didn't the Davening Amidah stop when the Bayit Sheni was built? Because if it was to replenish, I guess, the need of the Tamid, so if the Tamid came back, so it was like, oh, we don't need Amidah anymore. Maybe it's like a silly question.
No. You needed the Amidah to do the mitzvah of tefillah. According to the Rambam, once a day. According to the Ramban, optional.
But you didn't have the Amidah before.
It's only the twice a day. You're asking about twice a day. Why didn't go back to once a day?
Okay. Before the Beis Hamikdash was built, the first one,
right.
Shlomo Melech, was there an Amidah? No.
No.
But there was still a once a day obligation to daven?
According to the Rambam.
So then the better question would be, after the Bayit Sheni was rebuilt, it should have gone back to once a day instead of twice a day?
That's a better question, according to the Rambam.
Correct.
According to the Rambam, it should have gone back to once a day, and not twice a day. In fact, what happened was, it went to three times a day.
Right.
During Bayit Sheni.
Dates, very bad. Right, that's your question.
Right.
So in other words, we make it a little better. Not only didn't it go back to once a day, but it went to three times a day.
And even four and five.
So let's go to one part of what you said. What happened before? What does the Rambam think happened before? I think that what the Rambam thought was that everybody knew how to daven. That everybody knew how to just approach God and daven. In other words, they lived in a world where God's presence was unquestioned. Everybody in the world, Jews and non-Jews alike, I think, all felt the imminence of God's presence. And therefore you went to the place where you usually daven, whether it was at home or it was in a hall or it was in a Beit Knesset. You didn't have any difficulty speaking to God, because that was kind of the most natural thing that a person could do. And this is one of the sources that we will see, which is part of the introduction that is in Rav Kook's Sidur, Olat Re'iyah, about tefillah. That it's not something that was seen as being particularly remarkable. It was quite the contrary. I mean, everybody has needs, everybody has demands, everybody looks to God for support and for help. We're talking about the period before Anshei Knesset HaGdola made the Shemona Esrei. So the Rambam says, ask himself this question, if that's true, that the Jews as others were able to stand before God and beseech and say whatever was on their mind at the time. Then what happened? So the Rambam has this remarkable idea. Maybe we should look at it also tomorrow. I'll ask them to print it up. The Rambam has this remarkable idea, which is that when the Jews came back from Babel, Right, you remember the Churban, the Babylonian, the exile was 586 BCE. It's a good date to remember. You don't have to remember many dates, but that's a good one. 586 BCE. And the Jews came back 50 years later. And then more Jews came back 70 years later when they established the Beit HaMikdash. That means that the Persians, who allowed the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael, allowed them to return at approximately 535 BCE, right? 535, and the Chanukat HaMizbeach, the re-establishing of the altar, which was part of the Beit HaMikdash, ultimately was at 516 BCE. But you don't have to remember those dates because they're just 50 years and 70 years, right? So you could compute them. Or take out your phone and compute it on the phone. So the Rambam says that when the Jews came back to Eretz Yisrael, they had undergone a material change. Something happened to them. The Rambam calls it that they were unable to speak clearly in one language. I've never been able to understand what the Rambam is talking about. But the Rambam says that in the diaspora, in those 50 years of the diaspora, the 70 years for some people, and Ezra came back even later to Eretz Yisrael, they were unable to speak in a particular language. Linguists, for other reasons, entirely call this a mishsprach, a mixture of languages. You know, psychologists like to talk about children who grow up in homes where the parents speak one language and the street sweeps another language. Like, is it good for them or not good for them? I don't know. I don't think that it's not good for them. But I suppose it depends, like everything else. So, the Jews came back to Eretz Yisrael and were unable to daven. That's what the Rambam says. Why were they unable to daven? Because they could not formulate the davening, the words of davening, in a proper manner. So along came the Anshei Kneset HaGdola and said, here it is. We'll give it to you. We'll give you words that will always be proper. They'll always be appropriate. They will include all of the beseeching that you could possibly have, right? All the beseeching you possibly have. You just say this, and you've davened. That's what the Rambam says. This, of course, is amazing. It's amazing to me to imagine that in heaven, they don't understand the language of the people who speak a little bit of Hebrew and a little bit of Aramaic and a little bit of Persian, a little bit of whatever else they brought back with them. Nevertheless, that's what the Rambam says, and that's how the Rambam justifies. But if you abstract the Rambam, and you say what the Rambam is saying is that for some reason, people couldn't daven. They couldn't say the words properly. They couldn't deal with the demands of davening. If you say that, and you leave out why they couldn't daven. I mean, the Rambam says because they couldn't say the words. But if you leave that out, and you say they couldn't daven for some reason and they needed the text in order to kind of focus, they came back to a world without the Beit HaMikdash, without the ritual that existed before, and therefore, for some reason, they did not feel any longer that they were standing before God. And that the text helped them. It helped them to be the people who were able to daven. But you know that text was never enough for us. It was never enough for us because following Shemoneh Esrei every morning, we say Tachanun. Right? You know what Tachanun is? I don't mean, do you know what it is, technically. I mean, do you know what it is? Like, why do we say Tachanun? Why do we say Tachanun every day? Right, Monday and Thursday, apparently, we have more time, so we say a longer Tachanun. Right, other days we say a shorter Tachanun. What's Tachanun? Tachanun, as Rashi explains, is Rachum v'Chanun Rachel and the Chana addressing God. In other words, Shemot Esrei is not good enough. Shemot Esrei does not include everything we want to say. But what we want to add to Shemot Esrei is that because God is merciful, all of this will possibly take place. And we have exaggerated this kind of merciful side of our relationship to God, right? Rachamim, which was born at the time of the Chet HaEgel, right? Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanun. We take that idea, Erech HaPayim, Rav Chesed V'Emes, and we expand upon it. More Rachamim, and more Rachamim for what happened, and for what is happening, and for what might happen. We kind of say it without thinking about what we're saying, I would say, you know, imagine. And so that's how we get through it, because otherwise it would be terribly distressing. Yeah.
I may be jumping the gun with this question, but if somebody gets injured or has a sickness, I think they pretty much can clearly formulate in a very easy way to Hashem, please heal me from this as quickly as possible. So are we saying that unless somebody actually says Shemona Esrei, as a minimum, that Hashem is not going to necessarily answer that individual and give him that miracle of healing?
I mean, who's to blame if it doesn't work? Is that your question?
I'm asking, what is the, for those who even can't say Shemona Esrei or haven't learned how to say Shemona Esrei, and in their own words, they're just saying whatever comes to mind to ask Hashem for whatever it is that they want to ask. So would Hashem be Rachum V'Chanun and answer that individual's prayers, or do we need to, is it an obligation, a minimal obligation, to say certain tefillot before Hashem will even chime into what you're saying?
Look, I feel very complimented that you're asking me this question, but I haven't got a clue. I'm not going to second guess how God runs the world. I only know I'm talking about the world as seen from within the halachic system. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who have many zchuyot, much merit, who don't live within the halachic system. But I have no way of, I don't even imagine that I should think of judging them in any way. Yeah.
Rabbi, if I may, the last mine on Web Yeshiva, there were some courses on Tefillah, and there was a distinction made between the obligation of Tefillah, which is what we've been focusing on, and davening during an eighth Tzara, which would be what you're talking about. And so, it's totally different davening.
Well, the Ramban says that the Eitz Tzara, you probably have an obligation to daven. The Ramban says that. It was the two opinions, the two basic opinions, the opinions of the Ramban, the opinion of the Ramban. The Ramban also says that you have an obligation to daven sometimes. Not, you know, not all the time. The Ramban is the one who said you have an obligation to daven all the time. Right, it could be that the Rambam thought, the Rambam, you know, lived in a very difficult time. He himself, his own life was very difficult. He had to run from place to place. There was a lot of oppression in his life until he was about 30 years old and got to Alexandria. So, you know, there may be some connection there. But I'm not talking about how God relates to people outside of the system. I don't know. What I'm talking about is, what are the demands of the system? So what happened, I think, was that the Rambam said that people were no longer able to daven when they came back from Chutz La'aretz. They weren't able to daven. And because they weren't able to daven, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah gave them this vehicle called davening. But what happened with Kavanah? What happened with Kavanah? People still interested in daven. So if you look at the sheet, which has the Gemara on it, if you look at the sheet that has the Gemara on it, the Mishnah says, "Ein omdim litpalel, ela mitoch kovid rosh." So, So whatever Kovod Rosh means, I mean, we'll see in a minute what Rashi says it means, but Ein Omdim Litpalel Ela Mitoch Kovod Rosh seems like it means that not everybody was doing it. Not everybody was doing it properly. Ein Omdim Litpalel Ela Mitoch Kovod Rosh means that the Mishnah had to take the trouble of telling you something about Omdim Litpalel, about the fact that you daven is not the end of the story. I mean, it's not, you know, things are not finished. And so Rashi says that Kovod Rosh, Rabbi says Kovod Rosh Hachna'a. Hachna'a is a word that means to kind of give in. Give in. I mean, who are you giving in to? You're giving in to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that according to Rashi, the fact that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is in charge, or a Kodesh Baruch Hu is there, or that there is some kind of way of relating your tefillah to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that's obvious. But what's not obvious is that everybody has to do it all the time. So Rashi, the Mishnah says again, Einom dim litpalel, ela mitoch kovod rosh. And then there's Chasidim Arishonim. Chasidim Arishonim are brought into the Mishnah, even though they were a minority, and they were kind of, you couldn't expect everybody to live up to the standard of Chasidim Rishonim, which is why they're called Chasidim Rishonim. They're not the basic halachic position, but they are an extreme. They are doing something beyond what you would imagine. So Chasidim Rishonim, Ayu Shohim Sha'achat, Umit Palel, so that Chasidim Rishonim seem to respect the difficulty of Kavanah. That Kavanah suddenly became a problem. It was a problem in the Mishnah. Now you have to remember the Mishnah. Like, when was the Mishnah written? Like 250 to 250? You know, someplace in there, I mean, whoever likes dates. So that this is long after the Takana of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah to make Shemona Esrei. So long after that, the Chasidim HaRishonim, they said, people don't really daven properly. If you don't spend time getting yourself in the mood for Kavanah, so you're not davening properly. Now, what does that mean? That means that the world of the Tanakh, where people were walking with God, I mean, God was an obvious resident of the world in which we lived. And turning to speak to God was a kind of a normal thing. That was what normal people did. They turned to God, beseeched God about some troubles that they had. According to the Rambam, everybody understood you had to stop before you beseech God. You had to speak properly of the divine. You had to say Shevach, praising God, like we do in the first three brachot of the Shemona Esrei, right? And then you beseech God about particular issues that you had. And all of that was the most normal thing in the world. It was the most reasonable thing for anybody to do. But the Mishnah says that Chasidim HaRishonim Ayu Shohim Sha'achat Umitpalalim Kedei Sheyichavnu Libam Laviyem Shebashamayim. That suddenly this became a difficulty, like finding God every day in order to daven became an issue. And so the Mishnah says that, I think, in its way. But the Mishnah says, listen, all of you people who are davening, you're not doing a good job, because you're just focusing on the technical part of it, on the, what we would call today, the halachic part. And that's not good enough. Now, what you should do is not part of the suggestion in the Mishnah, but the Mishnah says, look, the serious people, the people who feel this lack, the people who are unable to kind of solve this problem, the people who are unable to solve this problem, well, those people do this kind of, have this way, right? Kedei sheyichavnu libam lavim shebashamayim. what was once obvious. Like you stand before God. I mean, that's in many shuls, you know, the Aron Kodesh, it says Dalif Ne Mishata Omed, like God is there in the shul. I mean, who thinks that today? I mean the more professional daveners, you know, the daveners who really daven every day, well, they can daven any place. They can daven on the train station, they get off on Kvish Mispar Sheish, you know, there's that big, what do they call it? You know where they have gas and ice cream, what?
Rest area.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a company that does it. It doesn't matter. you get out of your car, you get over the bus, and you daven mincha right there in the middle of Kvish Mispar Sheish, because that's how it works. You daven at the time that there is the daven. So if you happen to be in an odd place, it doesn't make any difference. So when I was a kid, that this is how what we learned, that, you know, if you have to daven and you're on a subway, you know, subway, New York, they have subways. So you get out of the train, you get out of the subway station, because that would not be so good to daven on the subway, and you go to the nearest phone booth. You know the phone booth is?
We're not there anymore.
They used to have phone booths. You go into the phone booth, you close the door of the phone booth, you take the phone off the hook so that somebody might think that you're actually talking, and you daven Shemone Esrei in that position. So this is not, believe me, my experience, this is not a position of kavanah. This is just a position of doing it, lahachis. You know, the world says you can't daven, like there's no place for you, there's no time for you. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it anyway. So that's how we did it. That's how we did it when we were kids. We davened in phone booths, or in, you know, whatever the most appropriate phone booth happened to be. So kavanah was not really one of our issues. But in the Mishnah, already very early on, when people daven by saying Shemone Esrei, the Mishnah recognizes the fact that Kavanah is an issue, and that the Hasidim Rishonim solved or tried to solve that problem by saying that you need lead time. You have to kind of run into it. You can't just start davening all the time. So what do? We say Psukei Dezimra, right? That's what we do. I mean, after all, Psukei Dezimra probably are not part of the essential obligation, of davening, right, which consists of Shema, which is certainly a mitzvah min haTorah, and Shemona Esrei, and there's some kind of a way of connecting. We connect Shema and Shemona Esrei, even though they would seem to be two different obligations entirely, which we will see in the Gemara as well. But Psukei Dezimra, they're just like things to put you in a good mood about your relationship to God, right? That, you know, there are good things that happen, not only bad things. And that, for example, Shirat Hayam, which is the end of Psukei Dezimra. But that's except on Shabbos we say Nishmat, but Nishmat is also Shirat Hayam, is like an optimistic, it's a very optimistic moment that we have, and that's what we do. Oh, what?
Isn't the Mishnah really talking about having a early reference?
But when you have to speak clearly, I don't hear you.
Wasn't the Mishnah actually talking about what we now call it Bodidu?
Who's we? Who's we? May we Braslov or Hasidim?
Well, you mentioned them first.
I don't know. Good. You could say it. I hit Bodidu. Like, whoever thinks that Bodidu is good, that maybe. I don't think the Braslov at Bodidu has to do so much with davening as it has to do with yourself, like at how you relate to God generally. What? Yeah.
As Rara said, if you think God is your father, how can you not talk to him?
Enochinami, 100%. Very good. But I mean, I think even the Bratzva Chassidim daven Shemone Esrei.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if their davening Shemone Esrei is different than anybody else's. But I think that the Mishnah relates to this problem. The end of the Mishnah turns us away from all of this, and the end of the Mishnah says, "Afilu Amelech Shoel B'Shlomo Lo Yishivenu." I mean, obviously, the king is not going to ask most people, "How are you doing today?" Right? You wouldn't expect. I mean, an English person would not expect Queen Elizabeth to be in shul and saying, "How you doing?" Oh, she would never say that anyway. You see, and what is it that brings you to this hallowed place at this particular time, you know, or something like that. She'd get a little written out on a card. So he says, even if the Queen of England shall Elvis Shlomo lo yeshivenu, which I guess means that you're supposed to concentrate on what you're doing and not allow idle disturbances to change things. And then the Mishnah says, "V'afilu nachash karucha l'akevo, lo yafsik." And even if there's a okay, so the Gemara says, of course, if it's a poisonous snake, you should probably stop and deal with it. But if it's a friendly snake, like, you know, the kind of snakes that people have as pets, I understand today that is a popular thing to have a snake as a pet. I guess they're quiet, right? It's like better than animals that make a lot of noise. So even if they have this kind of quiet snake grow, you know, like wrapped around your foot, as long as you know that it's not going to cause you danger, not going to endanger you, you should nevertheless ignore it. Ignore it so that if I had to think of what Kavanah means to the Mishnah, what Kavanah means to the Mishnah, so I think the Mishnah says concentrate. Concentrate on what you're doing. If you concentrate on what you're doing, that certainly is a kind of a Kavanah. And you know that in the history of things, we developed this complicated method of brachot. Right, you know about brachot. Now, there was the brachot divided into certain groups, but one of the groups of brachot is called Birkat HaMitzvah. Birkat HaMitzvah. Now, what's Birkat HaMitzvah? What is Birkat HaMitzvah? Birkat HaMitzvah, Asher Gidshanu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Netilat Lulav. What is Birkat HaMitzvah? I know what I'm doing, and I know that I'm doing it because God told me to do it, and for no other reason. I'm not shaking the lulav because it's hot, and maybe it'll cool me off a little bit, and maybe if everybody in shul has a lulav and shakes it together, then it's almost as good as air conditioning. No, that's not what it is. It's Asher Kedishanu Mitzvah Tzivanu, that there's a mitzvah in the Torah. I know what I'm doing. That's what the bracha means. So that I would assume that there was a time when people did not know what they were doing. They just did it, but it wasn't clear to them that it was a mitzvah min haTorah. Asher Gidshanu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Achilat Matzah. That there is such a mitzvah. I would say that by the time of the Arizal, right, in Tzfat, where the Arizal said, it's not enough to say a bracha, but you have to say Hineni Muchan Umezuman Mekayem Mitzvat, whatever the mitzvah is. That at the time that the Arizal instituted these kinds of things, that just saying a bracha was not good enough. People had become so used to saying the bracha that it must have been kind of it must have been almost a pro forma that you say the bracha, but you don't think about it too much. But if you have to add that whole bunch of words, you know, hidden imuchel mezun lekayim mitzvus kasekalad l'shem yichud kudshu brichu tamir, that you have to say all those words, you might actually think about them and what you were doing, and so that even though you know that it's a mitzvah, thinking that it's a mitzvah is good. like it's an important thing to think that it's a mitzvah. So that it would seem that at the time of the Arizal, the bracha was not enough. It wasn't good enough. It didn't produce kavanah. It didn't produce something special in the way you think about what you're doing. So you see that in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, where the brachot were invented, and many of the brachot are represented in the Torah itself, in the Gemara itself, the Gemara and brachot in different places, it became necessary to say more than that in order to achieve kavana. So we see that kavana is an issue. So again, we'll go back to the beginning. Ein omdim litpalel ela mitoch kovid rosh. Kovid rosh, Rashi says means hachna'a means accepting the yoke of heaven. Accepting the yoke of heaven, which sounds like the Rambam is right. That the Rambam says that tefillah is a mitzvah. Rashi says hachna'a, that's a mitzvah. Ein omdim litpalel, that's the mitzvah of tefillah, according to the Rambam. Ela mitoch kovid rosh. Chassidim Arishonim had difficulty with this. Ayushohin sha'achatu mitpalelim kedei sheyichavnu libam lavim shebashamayim. So what was in the time of the Tanakh, which was a long period of time, which was easy. It was easy for everybody to stand before HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to daven, became more difficult. Whether it was because of the way the Rambam said it, that they lost their ability to speak the words. They lost the ability to speak the words that were appropriate for davening, even though it's hard for me to understand what that possibly could mean. Nevertheless, it yielded what we call Shemona Esrei. Shemona Esrei became the kernel of Tefillah, and to which was added the Rachum V'Chanun of Tachanun, which came after the Tefillah, which we say to this very day, in a much more complicated presentation, several paragraphs that repeat again and again the misery of our situation and how we beg God to alleviate, to make it easier for us to live with ourselves in this kind of situation. Again, Rav Nachman of Breslov, I'll just tell you, we'll finish with this story. Not a story, it's like my estimate of things. Everybody knows that Rav Nachman of Breslov went to Eretz Yisrael. He landed near Akko, which was one of the places that you landed, and then he went to Tzvat, which was, considered a holy place, a holy city, a place to which people like him went to, because you know that earlier on, Rav Yosef Karo, who was a Talmud of the Arizal, and his whole Chavura Kedosha was in Tzvat, so he obviously went to Tzvat. From Tzvat he went to Tveria, where there was another community of a Hasidic community, Talmidei Habesht, who went to Eretz Yisrael, went eventually to Tveria. He looked around and he left. He went back to the Ukraine where he came from. It's hard for me to imagine that living in the Ukraine was better than living in Tveria, but for some reason, Rav Nachman went back. He went back. And it's not clear.
He didn't go to Yerushalayim at all?
No. Yerushalayim was the enemy. The capital city of the enemy. The enemy were the Litvaks, who were not Litvaks in those days, but they were not Hasidim either. So, Rav Nachman went back to the Ukraine, and he you know, and he set up his business as he did. So the question was, of course, like, why did he do that? Why did he go to Eretz Yisrael and leave? You could ask the same thing about the Baal HaTanya, who started out going to Eretz Yisrael with the Talmidim of the Magid Memesrich, but somehow got to Istanbul, even before the terrible things that happened in Turkey and our time, and he turned around and went back to Russia. So Rav Nachman went back to the Ukraine. Why did he go back to the Ukraine? So I think that that Rav Nachman saw himself as a messianic personality. This doesn't mean exactly that he thought he was the Messiah, but that he thought that he could have a tremendous influence on the Jewish world. And so when he went to Eretz Yisrael, he looked around and he thought everybody would come with him. There would be a lot of people who followed him, but in fact nobody did. So Rav Nachman said, the people are not ready for this. They're not ready to come to Eretz Yisrael, so I better go back and get them ready, and get them ready for this next stage in Jewish history. So you see that Rav Nachman was the one who realized that the people couldn't daven. He says, if they knew how to daven, they'd be with me. They'd be with me, with God, on our way to Eretz Israel to change Jewish history. And it's interesting that this idea was connected to Kavanah and davening and being, ready to take upon yourself the burden of going to Eretz Israel. So, what we're going to do tomorrow is three things. We're going to learn this Gemara until, just one second, we'll learn the Gemara until, which I would like you to prepare, because I'm going to teach at 9:15 in the morning. Right, so I want you to prepare the Gemara until, until Daf Lamed Aleph, the two dots in the eighth wide line. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Right, the two dots at the end of the eighth wide line. We'll learn that Gemara, and then we're going to learn the Rambam Hilchot Tefillah Perek Aleph, which you don't have, but I will get it for you. Rambam Perek Aleph Hilchot Tefillah, and then the first source in the Nefesh HaChaim, which you have here. Here you have there's the translation after the translation of the Gemara. Here it is, Nefesh HaChaim, page 16, right, Nefesh HaChaim, Shaar Beis Perek Aleph. I'll tell you a little bit about the Nefesh HaChaim tomorrow. So we'll do these three sources, right? The Gemara till where I told you, and then the Rambam, which I will get you, right? The Rambam Hilchot Tefillah Perek Aleph, where the Rambam points out some of the things that we talked about today, and the third source is the Nefesh HaChaim, and I'm going to teach that at 9:15 in the morning. I'll teach that at 9:15 in the morning, and so the time that's left now, it's 10:30, so you have some time. You could learn the Gemara, and we'll do that Gemara tomorrow morning. If there are any other questions about what I said,
shall we go through before the Nefesh HaChaim as a preparation, or
yes, you should prepare it.
How much?
There's the first section. The first section, Perek, whatever it is, Perek Beis, Halacha Aleph. And there's an English translation of the Nefesh HaChaim, which you can use. I mean, you should be able to prepare it yourselves. The Gemara you should try with the Chavrusa. Okay, all the best. Mm-hmm. And so tomorrow morning we start at 9:15. Yes, 9:15.